This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Atina Diffley. She's the author of an extraordinary and wonderful book called Turn Here, Sweet Corn, the subtitle of which is Organic Farming Works. Hi, Atina. How are you?
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for doing this. So you're in, just to, you know, kind of give the background for people who are listening, you're in Minnesota. Are you still in, you live in Eureka?
I'm in Eureka Township, Minnesota.
Right, which is south of the Twin Cities.
It's a rural township, the first one next to the Musa line of the Twin Cities.
Right.
So we look rural, but we are actually urban edge economics.
Right, and of course, this is a big part of the story of your book, which we'll get to. And over the last, say, you've been farming, or you farmed maybe for 30 years actively, and you're still involved in farming, but over that period of time around the Twin Cities, and I'm sure this is true in other urban areas, do you feel like the, you know, this conflict between urban, suburban, and rural land use, you know, has really, I mean, I think it's really changed over the last few years. Your story is actually, in so many ways, a microcosmic view of what has happened in America during that period of time where, you know, initially you were working on a on an organic farm in Eagan, which is much, much closer to the urban area. And when you talk about urban edge, Eagan is literally next to the Twin Cities. And as a suburban community by then, even by 1980s, there were no farms left, essentially, or they had all been pushed out by suburban development. And that's a big part of your story. It's like the emotional core of your story, I think, is that pushing you away from the land.
Yeah, and what Turn Here, Sweet Corn talks about as far as land loss and relationship to land is a story that could be told by literally millions of farmers. This is not a unique story, and that's the great tragedy. When you read Turn Here, Sweet Corn, it's so emotional. And the reader really ties in with the characters and their relationship to that land and the loss that they experience. And then to realize this has happened over and over and over to not only single farms, but to entire communities. And it's still happening. And it's been slowed down here in the Midwest by the economic downturn. But on the East Coast, it's still going gangbusters.
Well, no, it's true. Where I live in Connecticut, about an hour from New York, it's in the town I live in, which is, you know, a very small population, lost its last farm, working farm, in the 1990s. And there really has been now in the last few years an effort, and it's really hard, to restore farming to the suburban areas around New York City.
Yeah, we're still living like there's more land west of California, and there is not.
That's right. Well, and what's, you know, we know that suburban and urban development has basically taken the best land for farming.
Mm-hmm.
It goes there first because that's either flat land or land.
And that's where the early cities developed,
right,
in the areas with good land. And so there wasn't any thorough urban planning about what we're going to do with that land, what needs to be preserved, what needs to be protected.
Well, and do you, you know, and I think the, you know, I guess we're going right into sort of the issues that do you feel that the rise of organic farming over the last 35 years or so, which has really changed, I think, the way people think about food in many ways, has helped and will help people to realize the connection between land use policies and the food that goes on their table?
Absolutely. Because organic farming systems are all about protection and caring. They really mimic nature, the laws of nature. When you look at nature and how it manages the earth, it's all about protection and renewal, rebuilding. So the earth is kept covered. If there's any way a plant can grow on soil, the soil will have plants on it. It never has bare soil, and there's just, unless there's just not enough water and nutrients there to support life. And if that's the case, then there's bacteria that grows on the surface. And have you ever been to Utah? There's this cryptobiotic bacteria on the surfaces in the really dry regions there. And it's amazing to see how the surface of the earth is always covered by something. Life wants to be covered and protected. And then the whole process of renewal, which is part of everyday life of plants that die and decompose, and the renewal of the earth and the soil and the cycling of nutrients between all the forms of life. Organic farming systems simply follow the same laws of nature.
Right, and also you talk about this in the book, and I thought it was very important for people to realize that when we talk about sustainability, you know, the future where we may not have the availability of fossil fuel inputs, and I think a lot of people don't think about the connection between fossil fuels and farming. You know, that so much conventional farming is based on the insertion of fossil fuel-based fertilizer in order to increase yields, whereas organic farming is about building the soil for the long term and not using exterior outputs to the, you know, to that extent.
Yeah, so, you know, we hear all these discussions about agriculture, and they always go back to this question of yield. And it's the silliest discussion in the world, because it's not even the right question. And we know that organic farming can provide plenty of yield. Why are we arguing about 2% here and 5% there? That is not the question. All conversations about food and agriculture have got to be built around how they affect the environment, which affects all of life on the planet, which affects us. And that's something that the environmental movement really needs to come and really get around and gather around. And environmentalism really isn't about just wilderness. It's about our food and how we are on the planet. It's our food is our single largest land use for land in the entire world. About 40% of the world's land is in agricultural purposes. So what we do there really, really, really makes a difference. And that's what's so crucial, is because every single human being has a relationship to the land that feeds them. So they might never see that land. They might not have anything to do with it. They might not even know where the land is that's feeding them. But they still have a relationship with that land. So the decisions they make every single day of their life about their food completely affects the wellness of the land that's feeding them, and then all the life that's on that land. So it gives that eater a lot of power, and whether they're making the decision and aware of it in a conscious way or not, their decisions are still affecting that land.
Well, that's true. And I think the difficulty for most of us is that because of the way the industrial agriculture system and the food distribution system has worked, you know, we end up going to giant supermarkets that put the food out, but there's no explanation of where the food comes from. There's no differentiation between a fruit grown in Chile and a fruit grown in California or Florida. You know, people are not aware of how the choices they make in eating affects everything around them. And so
that's
think
why the organic label is so crucial, because it's really the only food label we have with real standards that are verifiable and certifiable. So a lot of people want to actually know their farmer, and that's even better. But when we are in communities where that's not simple to do, or our lives aren't going to allow it because it would perhaps take too much time to get to the farmer's market during certain limited hours or whatever, organic food has at least been grown to a certain standard.
Well, and we'll go, that's sort of a good segue into talking a little bit more about your story. You come from a farming family in Wisconsin, and you ended up in Minnesota back, you know, at a time when I think the organic food growing movement was much smaller than it is today. So you've been part of that tremendous growth and and change over this period of time in how people are aware of or how organic farming relates to to communities. And so, and in the book, I thought, aside from your own story, which I thought was really interesting and impressive, you talk a lot about the support that you've had as a farmer from the local community in the Twin Cities, the food co-ops in particular. And maybe, do you feel that that connection that has been built over these years between the consumers and their proxies, the food co-ops and the farmers, is you think that's a model for how other communities could operate, or for
Oh, yes, absolutely. What has happened in Minneapolis-St. Paul, Twin Cities community around food and farmers is unprecedented. We have over 75,000 food co-op members, and those food co-ops are based on the members' needs. So it's a really different model than the corporate food store model, where they have to be sure they're making a profit for the shareholders. The food co-ops exist to serve the members' needs, and these members are saying we want to support local and organic farmers, and that's what we want in our stores. So they have made commitments to farmers at an unprecedented level. We've had written agreements with our stores since the early 80s, 1980s. So we were always able to plant knowing that we had a secure market. And farmers deal with so many variables beyond their control, such as the weather or violent storms, not being able to access seed. And to have the market secure really, really makes a difference for a farmer. And not many farmers have that. So not only did we have it as a security in the marketplace and knowing we could plant crops and they would purchase them for a fair price, but they promoted us, they used our point of purchase materials, they got our name out there, they called us heroes at a time where farmers were still dung of the earth and had no respect, and it was really seen as low class. They really created this huge change in customer awareness around the work that farmers are doing and how crucial it is. So they've really been allies for the farmers here, and because of that, there are literally hundreds of successful organic farms in the Twin Cities serving the community, and we have a really stable, mature food system just outside of the conventional one.
So, do you think that does, I know of in other places, in let's say in New York, in the New York area, where there's a huge growth in the desire people have to eat locally, and they recognize the value, not only in terms of the community values, but also, there's political, social, commercial, and climate reasons to have to eat as locally as you can. So food systems, that have become specialized kind of need to become despecialized, where all grain is grown in, the Dakotas and then shipped all over America. Theoretically, in the 19th century, grain was grown in upstate New York. So, there people are there are trying to restore a kind of more holistic localism that enables a community to eat from its surroundings on a larger level. I mean, I don't think there's any, feeling that people are going to live without bananas, or people are never going to eat oranges because they only grow in Florida and California. We will never come to a completely localized growing and eating system. But, do you see that? I mean, is that happening around the Twin Cities as well, where you're looking at a growth in organic grain farmers and other kinds of farming that, because your story is tip is really about vegetable farming, and I'm just curious what, whether there's more going on.
Oh, yeah, we've got dairy farmers that are doing on-farm processing. We have a lot of on-farm processing of cheese. You can get your meats, your grains. There's a wonderful sunflower oil and another one that's doing pumpkin oil. Up in Duluth, where you used to live, there's been a really wonderful food assessment done for the entire North Shore region, and they're bringing in a fish factory right on Silver Bay there. And they've drawn a design for how they can actually produce all of the food that they need from within that region. So people think regionally now, which is a little different than the word local, in that we look at our bioshed, our food region, and see what areas have different strengths and where foods can come from. This is happening nationally. It's really exciting. And, if you know, we are all co-creators of this movement, and it really is a movement for a major change. And I think this is a really important people to note, because people sometimes get discouraged, and there's a lot of kind of name-calling of major corporations, and people feel powerless because those corporations have so much money and they're so large and they have such a large share of the market. But this is where the true change really happens, is when people get together on that grassroots level and make those changes in their own communities. That ripples out. It's a model. People can see it's a healthier, higher quality of life, and they want that for themselves. Do you know, in surveys, something like 75% of people say they would like to buy organic food?
I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
So we have the people wanting it, and partly we have supply issues still, and when you look at the price of organic, a lot of that is based on status quo and specialty crop. When you look at that, we have the entire system built around a conventional commodity crop. They have these economies of scale that a specialty market just can't meet. And we have all sorts of extra expenses as organic farmers, in that we have to protect ourselves from the chemical users by providing the buffer strips, and we have to ensure there's no drift. So we have these onerous extra costs, which is what the consumer ends up seeing. When you really get down to the brass knuckles of a farming system, and if you take out all these external costs that are being affected by scale and status quo, and the fact that that's just the structure, organic doesn't cost that much more than conventional. So as we move forward in time, as fossil fuels rise in price, and you start to really see how organic fertility is actually the least expensive fertility in the world and will give you the highest return as far as quality and long-term food reliability, then you start to see organic is really a bargain.
Well, I think that's true also. You know, we have there's sort of externalities that are not accounted for in conventional farming. That's true of almost all economic behavior, that the downstream costs of all of those chemicals used in conventional agriculture are not accounted for in the price. They're accounted for in other places. So people have, you know, the comparison is even incorrect, that, you know, if you're looking at an organic broccoli and it costs 50 cents more than a conventional, the 50 cents can be, as you said, could be accounted for in other ways, but also could be paid for in other ways much longer, you know, in a longer time frame, so that the savings are kind of false savings.
It's one of the reasons Europe has such a higher amount of organic than we do. Many European countries are about 20%. We're somewhere in the, well, if you look at just our agricultural land, we're under 1%. If you look at the market, we're between 4% to 6%, depending on what surveys you go with. So we're a long ways behind Europe, but Europe has had a policy in place for years where they actually finance organic farmers to transition to organic. So they get support in that transition process. And their equivalent of the USDA has promotional slogans such as organic is better for you and for the environment. So they've really promoted it, whereas in the United States, organic has been seen as a marketing tool, but it's not perceived as better by the USDA. They have refused to have any discussion around that.
And do you think also that kind of raises a question about kind of public support, public good, that the idea of having local farms, regional farms supported by the community directly or indirectly is a really good thing. And you see where, you know, in the, I thought that, you know, you're writing about Egan and the loss of the land there, I thought was very powerful. This was a family farm that your husband had been, his family had been connected to for five generations, and by the time you're working the farm, working the land, essentially the pressures of development overwhelmed the ability to keep that farm going. And I think that whole issue of land near cities is really important, where we need to have political support for keeping land in farm. That's a taxing policy issue, it's a land use issue in terms of zoning. Communities can do that. And I'm wondering now, that the period of time where Egan lost the Diffley Farm, Gardens of Egan, was the 1980s. Do you think today, 25 or 30 years later, there is a feeling in that community that they wish they had been able to preserve farms in order to both change the, it's sort of a life quality issue, but it's also the political issue of supporting local farming. Do you think there's a regret there in that community?
Well, I don't think there is at the city level because Egan has really been part of the ladder climbing into higher political positions in Minnesota. So our governor, for example, Pawlenty, was on the city council before he became governor. And a lot of those city council positions were held by developers. So they have no awareness of that whatsoever. They really just saw that as open land to do with as they wanted. But when we look at it from a societal perspective, I think that our relationship with land is actually tied from our exodus from agriculture. And you can look at this in various socioeconomic and different communities. If you go in the South, you see this great migration of black people from agriculture, where agriculture was almost a carryover for them of slavery because they continued on as sharecroppers and they had their lives weren't that much better. They were still really hard. So in the 40s and 50s, there was this huge great migration for those people out of the South into urban areas to escape. And there was so much social agriculture was really seen as low class. And that is true, I think, in every community. In my childhood, when I look at my grandparents, they didn't want to be farmers necessarily. On the one hand, they loved farming, that relationship with land, but the social pressure of leaving the farm was very strong, and they did stay in agriculture, but they felt shame around it. So it's really recent that we have started to call farmers heroes and recognize how crucial they are in our society and seeing them as intelligent beings. And because of that connection to land that farmers have, I think we've had that same disregard for the land and just assumed there was always more and we could do what we wanted with it. And there hasn't been a society-wide understanding of how dependent, utterly dependent, we are on land and nature. That's what is so valuable about Turn Here, Sweet Corn as a book. When we were losing that land in Egan to development, we witnessed ecological collapse on this microcosm of that farm because as organic farmers, our fertility and our pest and disease systems were based on maintaining biological habitat and diversity. And that habitat hosted the life forms that controlled our pests and maintained our disease organisms and that recycled our nutrients for our fields and that gave us the ecosystem service of water management. So when they started developing it, we continued to farm immediately adjacent to the land that was under development. It was 120 acres, and they took it in 5 years, one piece at a time. So we continued to farm the land that was not yet developed, immediately adjacent to the land of which all life had been removed. They took out every tree, every bush, every grass, every forb, the life all left. They even removed the living topsoil. So we went from having farming being really relatively simple in that our systems were whole systems based on that environment, to an ecological collapse where we had terrible disease and pest problems. When it would rain, there was no life left on that land to take the water in, and so there was terrible erosion. We lost many of our crops to being buried under soil. So I got it at a gut level, at a heart level, through that experience, how dependent we are on nature. And we just think we're above nature. We don't really understand as human beings that we are completely part of it. Everything we do in nature, we do to ourselves. But we think we can just take. So that kind of thinking really has to change, because it can't function that way for the long term.
Yeah, I thought that was actually a very powerful part of your book. I mean, it's, you know, there was a great, I mean, I appreciated the personal loss that you wrote about in the painfulness of watching that farm be destroyed. But it also does lead to a sort of political and ecological awareness, which I think you just talked about, that one conclusion would be there you could change the way you do development. You know, it doesn't mean that you can't build houses anymore.
Right.
You know, but you have to build houses that are build houses in a way that does not destroy the land as well. Or
we have to write some criteria about what we want to protect, what we value, how we can work in harmony with it so we're not destroying it.
Yeah.
We don't have to have less. We can have perfectly wonderful, wealthy, rich lives. We don't have to go back to living in log cabins. This is not what this is about.
I know. It's people do simplify the whole issue as, you know, you're trying to stop progress, or you're trying to take us back to the 19th century. And I thought you were very, you know, your book is very positive. It's all about, intelligence and understanding. I think organic is, as you described it, it's you give meaning to the word. You know, people use the label organic sometimes probably not even realizing the complexity of the work that goes into that, or the complexity of the thinking about trying to make agriculture work in harmony with nature. It is hard work, but I think what you're saying is in this book, or at least the takeaway can be applied to many different things, not just to the agriculture itself.
And you know, nature is inherently bountiful. Nature wants to reproduce. When you watch nature, it's just screaming with life. And when we nurture that and take care of that, it nurtures and takes care of us. It's really a very simple formula. And we see it all the time on an organic farm. We think the most valuable and least expensive fertility we can create is by really taking care of the life in our soil. And when we do that, that life takes care of us. So we see all these ways that nature is so inherently bountiful, and we are really just wasting that opportunity when we look at this from any perspective, whether it's like energy and all of the energy that is available for us to tap in a natural form, whether it's wind or solar, all those energy forces, we really could be powering ourselves and having plenty of electricity based on those sorts of renewable sources. But we haven't had that mind thought. It's like we're still in manifest destiny. And it's time to really change that thinking. And that's going to come from the ground up. And it's just really exciting to see this swell of people who understand this and know that we can create really, really rich lives in this relationship.
So just to kind of take us through the book, what you cover in this book is your life story. It's your personal story, which I think, you know, you give, I think you're very brave in telling your story. I think personalized it and made it easy for someone reading it to kind of understand what you went through as a human being. But during the course of this time, you moved to Eureka, and Eureka has been a really successful, and now you're still on that land, right?
We are still on our farm, yeah.
And you sold the the farming operation, or the name Gardens of Egan, which is the one that had been established in Egan, Minnesota. You sold that to one of the co-ops in 2008. So what have you been doing for the last several years?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So we did get to a point in our lives where we still loved farming, and we wanted to be able to do more with our lives. And the farm was so all-consuming that it didn't allow us to develop other parts of ourselves. So we made the decision to sell our business name, which was a brand name at that point in time, and our equipment. And we sold it to one of our customers, the Wedge Community Co-op, and they started to lease our land and continued to run the operation. So that freed up Martin and I wrote a book. That took me a while. And so now I do a lot of writing. I do consulting with farmers. Tomorrow I'm going to Wisconsin. I'll be visiting 5 different farms over the course of 2 days and giving them advice and walking through their systems. I do a lot of teaching. I teach all around the country different farming classes. So getting the word out, past sharing the information that we've gained from all of our years of farming with a broader public, it seemed the next step work, really, as we look at how we can move this forward. I wanted to be able to feed people with more than just food, but with information. And that's what's so key when we look at changing these systems, is that they're really information-based systems. It's not just reaching for a different input when we look at what is organic farming or how are we going to create different types of lives that are more compatible with protecting the environment. It's not just a matter of using a different product. We really have to understand how processes work, and it's very information-based. So that will be really key in the education and the change, is having information sources so that people know how to make these things happen.
Do you think one of the things I picked up from the book, which was, I thought you wrote about this really beautifully, was the ability that you and Martin developed, or maybe had inherently, I don't know, to really understand the different parts of your farm. You know, that you have different soil and different drainage and different, you know, just different landscapes, even, you know, in a single farm area, and that you really worked hard at matching the right environment, the right micro agricultural area to a particular crop or vegetable. So, you know, cantaloupes, you know, muskmelons go in one particular area because that's the right place for them. And is that something that you're able to teach when you do, you know, when you do this kind of work? I mean, is that something that you find that people who are already farming or who are interested in farming don't understand, how it's that you as the farmer, you as the gardener, if it's applying to you in the backyard, you have to really look at the place where you are and internalize an understanding of it so that you can connect that to the kinds of crops or vegetables or plants that you're putting in?
Yeah, I think that's really about relationship and observation, which organic farmers tend to really do versus dominance and control. So, you know, when I drive through western Minnesota, it really feels like dominance and control. And it's corn and soybeans, and now it's corn, corn, corn. So there really isn't this asking of the land, what does the land need? What does the other life on the land need? There's simply the farmer saying, I'm going to grow corn. This is the way I'm going to do it. These are the inputs I'm going to use. So our thinking is more of a relationship thinking. How does this crop affect what's going on here? And we are affecting all this other life on the land. So we have to ask it what it needs and get some input from it. And when I say ask it, you know, obviously we can't say something to it in English and expect it to answer us back. It has its own language. And we as human beings don't necessarily have the ability, most of us, to listen to that tree's language. And we have to develop that. And one of the ways we develop that is through observation. So we can watch a plant or the other life that's sharing this land with us and watch how it lives. What does it need? What does it need to eat? If you go in the middle of a cornfield that just stretches on and there's no life growing there except for one species, it's going to be very limited what other life can exist there. And we want the opposite of that. We want to bring all these different forms of life back onto this land that we're here before humans came and really changed the landscape. So observation and relationship, we really recognize that everything we're doing as human beings out there in those fields, it's affecting all the other life on this land. And we have to take that into consideration as we make our farming decisions. So that's back to what I said earlier, that every single human actually has a relationship with land, the land that feeds them. Even if they live in the middle of the largest, most urban area, that food is coming from land, and that land has other life on it, or should have other life on it. And those decisions they make really affect the wellness of that life.
I think that's really good. I like your observation. I think you're right, this the idea of observation versus dominance and control, listening as opposed to trying to impose your will. Those are important differentiators, I think, that sometimes we don't recognize in ourselves, that, you know, that our whole culture is based on trying to dominate as opposed to exist in harmony. With, you know, the, I mean, it's sort of trite, I guess, but to exist in harmony with nature is really a much more long-term kind of thinking, and we have short-term thinking that dominates everything.
And I think you can draw a parallel to these, any relationship, and we can see them easier when we look at human relationships. If you have a marriage where one person is dominant and in control, would you consider it a healthy marriage?
Right.
And it's not any different if it's our relationship with nature or with any other living species. You know, when you really get down to it, I find this to be just really profound, no matter how many times I think about it, but our human bodies are made up of the exact same stuff that a tree is made of, or a bird, or an insect, or the life in the soil. We're made of the same minerals and elements. And we're really passing those nutrients between these different forms of life. That's the life, part of that life process. So we really aren't that different. We think we are, but we have really similar needs. You know, air, food, and water, and we come from the same stuff. And that's pretty profound.
Yeah, I think that's true. Well, do you think that that message is more possible to be heard by, you know, you have this sort of feeling that people will only hear a message when they're ready. They'll only be able to absorb information when they're ready to make use of it. Do you feel that that's
right,
changing now, that people are more inclined to understand that because of, I mean, there are so many different factors, but I think you must. I guess I'm asking that question rhetorically, but do you feel like that the world is more open to this message today than it was previously?
I think absolutely. I think people are adjusting their expectations in life away from things. I mean, we still all want a comfortable life and a home and enough money to live a good life. But we're starting to recognize that there's a lot more important than that. And there's a lot of social justice and awareness of other people in the world and how our lives affect their lives. And I think that people have gotten, the disconnect from nature is starting to, people are starting to feel it. We are about 50 to 80 years away from this mass migration away from land. So that when I was a child, everybody I knew had at least an uncle on a farm and an aunt, if they weren't themselves on a farm. And so now we have a couple generations away from that, where there's people that really don't know anyone who lives on a farm or have never been to a farm or never been out of a city. And that disconnect from nature is starting to kind of rise up, and people want that. It's one of the reasons I wrote Turn Here Sweet Corn and gave that bulldozer scene so strongly, is that people actually need to feel that loss to be able to rise up and recognize why it's so crucial to do something about it. And that's what it takes to create action in a person, is they have to feel it. It can't just be intellectual. And in Turn Here, Sweet Corn, the reader really feels my children's loss with land and nature and their loss of this land that they've really loved. And it's really a spiritual loss. This relationship we have with nature really is a spiritual relationship. If you really go to the spirit and that life force. So when you look at children, I mean, have you ever met a child who doesn't love a seed? And the excitement of putting a seed in soil and giving it some water and seeing it come to life thrills every child. When I bring inner city children out to the land, I don't have to give them any kind of lecture about nature. We just go for a walk on the farm. And they are thrilled to eat a leaf of parsley or to learn that they can go in the woods and eat a berry that just is growing there that no one planted. That is such an important experience for them. So, as a race, we're starting to recognize how crucial it is that we start to protect this relationship and recognize it for what it is. It's a really important part of our spiritual wellness.
Oh, that's really well put. And I really want to thank you, Atina, for writing a wonderful book. I think it is an extraordinary piece of writing. I didn't really get to say that before, but your writing style is fantastic. Your abilities are amazing. So I wanted to thank you for doing this, and
Thank
thanks
you.
for talking to me. I hope a lot more people will read this book, and I wish you luck with it.
Thank you.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Atina Diffley. Her book is Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and you can find her at atinadiffley.com. Thanks so much.